Chapter 66. Rebecca had the pleasure of seeing her ladyship in the horseless carriage, and keeping her eyes fixed upon her, and bewailing, in the loudest tone of voice, the Countess's perplexities. Ought to be able to get horses, she said, and to have all those diamonds sewed into the carriage cushions. What a prize it will be for the French when they come, the carriage and the diamonds, I mean, not the lady. She gave this information to the landlord, to the servants, to the guests, and the innumerable stragglers about the courtyard. Lady Barrisers could have shot her from the carriage window. It was while enjoying the humiliation of her enemy that Rebecca caught sight of Joe's, who made towards her directly he perceived her. That altered, frightened, fat face told his secret well enough. He too wanted to fly, and was on the lookout for the means of escape. He shall buy my horses, thought Rebecca, and I'll ride the mare. Joe's walked up to his friend, and put the question for the 100th time during the past hour, did she know where horses were to be had? What, you fly? Said Rebecca, with a laugh. Thought you were the champion of all the ladies, Mr. Sedley. I'm not a military man, gasped he. And Amelia? Who is to protect that poor little sister of yours? Asked Rebecca, who surely would not desert her? What good can I do her, suppose the enemy arrive? Joe's answered, Hail spare the women, but my man tells me that they have taken an oath to give no quarter to the men, the dastardly cowards. Horrid! Cried Rebecca, enjoying his perplexity. Besides, I don't want to desert her, cried the brother. She shan't be deserted. There is a seat for her in my carriage, and one for you, dear Mrs. Crawley, if you will come, and if we can get horses, sidey, I have two to sell, the lady said. Joe's could have flung himself into her arms at the news. At the carriage, Isidore, he cried. We found them, we have found them. My horses never were in harness, added the lady. B. Bullfinch would kick the carriage to pieces, if you put him in the traces. But he is quiet to ride? Asked the civilian. As quiet as a lamb, and as fast as a hare, answered Rebecca. Do you think he is up to my weight? Joe said. He was already on his back, in imagination, without ever so much as a thought for poor Amelia. What person who loved a horse speculation could resist such a temptation? In reply, Rebecca asked him to come into her room, whither he followed her quite breathless to conclude the bargain. Joe seldom spent a half hour in his life which cost him so much money. Rebecca, measuring the value of the goods which he had for sale by Joe's eagerness to purchase, as well as by the scarcity of the article, put upon her horses a price, so prodigious as to make even the civilian draw back. He would sell both or neither, she said, resolutely. Rodin had ordered her not to part with them for a price less than that which she specified. Lord Barrisers below would give her the same money, and with all her love and regard for the Sedley family, her dear Mr. Joseph must conceive that poor people must live nobody, in a word, could be more affectionate, but more firm about the matter of business. Joe's ended by agreeing, as might be supposed of him. The sum he had to give her was so large, that he was obliged to ask for time, so large as to be a little fortune to Rebecca, who rapidly calculated that with this sum, and the sale of the residue of Rodin's effects, and her pension as a widow should he fall, she would now be absolutely independent of the world, and might look her weeds steadily in the face. Once or twice in the day she certainly had herself thought about flying. But her reason gave her better counsel. Oppose the French do come, thought Becky, what can they do to a poor officer's widow? Bah! The times of sacks and sieges are over. We shall be let to go home quietly, or I may live pleasantly abroad with a snug little income. Meanwhile Joe's and Isidore went off to the stables, to inspect the newly purchased cattle. Joe's bade his man saddle the horses at once. He would ride away that very night, that very hour. And he left the valet busy in getting the horses ready, and went homewards himself to prepare for his departure. It must be secret. He would go to his chamber by the back entrance. He did not care to face Mrs. O'Dowd and Amelia, and own to them that he was about to run. By the time Joe's bargain with Rebecca was completed, and his horses had been visited and examined, it was almost morning once more. But though midnight was long past, there was no rest for the city. The people were up, the lights in the houses flamed, crowds were still about the doors, and the streets were busy. Rumors of various natures went still from mouth to mouth. One report averred that the Prussians had been utterly defeated. Another that it was the English who had been attacked and conquered. A third that the latter had held their ground. This last rumor gradually got strength. No Frenchmen had made their appearance. Stragglers had come in from the army bringing reports more and more favorable. At last an aide-de-camp actually reached Brussels with dispatches for the commandant of the place, who placarded presently through the town an official announcement of the success of the Allies at Quatre Bras, and the entire repulse of the French under Ney after a 6 hours' battle. The aide-de-camp must have arrived sometime, while Joe's and Rebecca were making their bargain together, or the latter was inspecting his purchase. When he reached his own hotel, he found a score of its numerous inhabitants on the threshold discoursing of the news. There was no doubt as to its truth. And he went up to communicate it to the ladies under his charge. He did not think it was necessary to tell them how he had intended to take leave of them, how he had bought horses, and what a price he had paid for them. But success or defeat was a minor matter to them, who had only thought for the safety of those they loved. Amelia, at the news of the victory, became still more agitated even than before. She was for going, that moment, to the army. She besought her brother with tears to conduct her thither. Her doubts and terrors reached their paroxysm, and the poor girl, who for many hours had been plunged into stupor, raved and ran hither and thither in hysteric insanity, a piteous sight. No man writhing in pain on the hard-fought field 15 miles off, where lay, after their struggles, so many of the brave, no man suffered more keenly than this poor harmless victim of the war. Joe's could not bear the sight of her pain. He left his sister in the charge of her stouter female companion, and descended once more to the threshold of the hotel, where everybody still lingered, and talked, and waited for more news. It grew to be broad daylight as they stood here, and fresh news began to arrive from the war, brought by men who had been actors in the scene. Wagons and long country carts laden with wounded came rolling into the town. Ghastly groans came from within them, and haggard faces looked up sadly from out of the straw. Joe Sedley was looking at one of these carriages with a painful curiosity. The moans of the people within were frightful. The wearied horses could hardly pull the cart. Stop! Stop! A feeble voice cried from the straw, and the carriage stopped opposite Mr. Sedley's hotel. It is George, I know it is! Cried Amelia, rushing in a moment to the balcony, with a pallid face and loose flowing hair. It was not George, however, but it was the next best thing. It was news of him. It was poor Tom Stubble, who had marched out of Brussels, so gallantly 24 hours before, bearing the colors of the regiment, which he had defended very gallantly upon the field. A French lancer had speared the young ensign in the leg, who fell, still bravely holding to his flag. At the conclusion of the engagement, a place had been found for the poor boy in a cart, and he had been brought back to Brussels. Mr. Sedley, Mr. Sedley! Cried the boy, faintly, and Joe's came up almost frightened at the appeal. He had not at first distinguished who it was that called him. Little Tom Stubble held out his hot and feeble hand. I'm to be taken in here, he said. Sporn and Ann Dobbin said I was, and you are to give the man 2 napoleons. My mother will pay you. This young fellow's thoughts, during the long feverish hours passed in the cart, had been wandering to his father's parsonage which he had quitted only a few months before, and he had sometimes forgotten his pain in that delirium. The hotel was large, and the people kind, and all the inmates of the cart were taken in and placed on various couches. The young ensign was conveyed upstairs to Osborne's quarters. Amelia and the major's wife had rushed down to him when the latter had recognized him from the balcony. You may fancy the feelings of these women when they were told that the day was over, and both their husbands were safe. In what mute rapture Amelia fell on her good friend's neck, and embraced her. In what a grateful passion of prayer she fell on her knees, and thanked the power which had saved her husband. Our young lady, in her fevered and nervous condition, could have had no more salutary medicine prescribed for her by any physician than that which chance put in her way. She and Mrs. O'Dowd watched incessantly by the wounded lad, whose pains were very severe, and in the duty thus forced upon her, Amelia had not time to brood over her personal anxieties, or to give herself up to her own fears and forebodings after her wound. The young patient told in his simple fashion the events of the day, and the actions of our friends of the gallant TH. They had suffered severely. They had lost very many officers and men. The major's horse had been shot under him as the regiment charged, and they all thought that O'Dowd was gone, and that Dobbin had got his majority, until on their return from the charge to their old ground, the major was discovered seated on Pyramus's carcass, refreshing himself from a case bottle. It was Captain Osborne that cut down the French lancer who had speared the ensign. Amelia turned so pale at the notion that Mrs. O'Dowd stopped the young ensign in this story. And it was Captain Dobbin who at the end of the day, though wounded himself, took up the lad in his arms and carried him to the surgeon, and thence to the cart which was to bring him back to Brussels. And it was he who promised the driver to Lewis, if he would make his way to Mr. Sedley's hotel in the city, and tell Mrs. Captain Osborne that the action was over, and that her husband and was unhurt and well. Indeed, but he has a good heart that William Dobbin, Mrs. O'Dowd said, though he is always laughing at me. Young Stubble vowed there was not such another officer in the army, and never ceased his praises of the senior captain, his modesty, his kindness, and his admirable coolness in the field. To these parts of the conversation, Amelia lent a very distracted attention. It was only when George was spoken of that she listened, and when he was not mentioned, she thought about him. In tending her patient, and in thinking of the wonderful escapes of the day before, her second day passed away not too slowly with Amelia. There was only one man in the army for her. And as long as he was well, it must be owned that its movements interested her little. All the reports which Joe's brought from the streets fell very vaguely on her ears, though they were sufficient to give that timorous gentleman, and many other people then in Brussels, every disquiet. The French had been repulsed certainly, but it was after a severe and doubtful struggle, and with only a division of the French army. The Emperor, with the main body, was away at Ligny, where he had utterly annihilated the Prussians, and was now free to bring his whole force to bear upon the Allies. The Duke of Wellington was retreating upon the capital, and a great battle must be fought under its walls probably, of which the chances were more than doubtful. The Duke of Wellington had but 20,000 British troops on whom he could rely, for the Germans were raw militia, the Belgians disaffected, and with this handful his grace had to resist 150,000 men that had broken into Belgium under Napoleon. Under Napoleon! What warrior was there, however famous and skillful, that could fight at odds with him? Joe's thought of all these things, and trembled. So did all the rest of Brussels, where people felt that the fight of the day before was but the prelude to the greater combat which was imminent. One of the armies opposed to the Emperor was scattered to the winds already. The few English that could be brought to resist him would perish at their posts, and the conqueror would pass over their bodies into the city. Woe be to those whom he found there. Addresses were prepared, public functionaries assembled and debated secretly, apartments were got ready, and tricolored banners and triumphal emblems manufactured, to welcome the arrival of His Majesty the Emperor and King. The emigration still continued, and wherever families could find means of departure, they fled. When Joe's, on the afternoon of the 17th of June, went to Rebecca's hotel, he found that the great barrister's carriage had at length rolled away from the porte-cochere. The Earl had procured a pair of horses somehow, in spite of Mrs. Crawley, and was rolling on the road to Ghent. Louis the Desired was getting ready his portmanteau in that city too. It seemed as if misfortune was never tired of worrying into motion that unwieldy exile. Joe's felt that the delay of yesterday had been only a respite, and that his dearly bought horses must of a surety be put into requisition. His agonies were very severe all this day. As long as there was an English army between Brussels and Napoleon, there was no need of immediate flight. But he had his horses brought from their distant stables, to the stables, in the courtyard of the hotel where he lived, so that they might be under his own eyes, and beyond the risk of violent abduction. Isidor watched the stable door constantly, and had the horses saddled, to be ready for the start. He longed intensely for that event. After the reception of the previous day, Rebecca did not care to come near her dear Amelia. She clipped the bouquet which George had brought her, and gave fresh water to the flowers, and read over the letter which he had sent her. "Poor wretch," she said, twirling round the little bit of paper in her fingers, "how I could crush her with this! And it is for a thing like this, that she must break her heart, forsooth, for a man who is stupid, a coxcomb, and who does not care for her. My poor good Rawdon is worth 10 of this creature." And then she fell to thinking what she should do, if anything happened to poor good Rawdon, and what a great piece of luck it was that he had left his horses behind. In the course of this day too, Mrs. Crawley, who saw not without anger the barrister's party drive off, bethought her of the precaution which the Countess had taken, and did a little needlework for her own advantage. She stitched away the major part of her trinkets, bills, and banknotes about her person, and so prepared, was ready for any event to fly, if she thought fit, or to stay, and welcome the conqueror, were he Englishman or Frenchman. And I am not sure, that she did not dream that night of becoming a duchess and Madame La Marechale, while Rawdon wrapped in his cloak, and making his bivouac under the rain at Mount St. John, was thinking, with all the force of his heart, about the little wife whom he had left behind him. The next day was a Sunday, and Mrs. Major O'Dowd had the satisfaction of seeing both her patients refreshed in health and spirits by some rest which they had taken during the night. She herself had slept on a great chair in Amelia's room, ready to wait upon her poor friend or the ensign, should either need her nursing. When morning came, this robust woman went back to the house, where she and her major had their billet, and here performed an elaborate and splendid toilet, befitting the day. And it is very possible, that whilst alone in that chamber, which her husband had inhabited. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.